Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Palestinian slam as collective punishment. The Israeli move to close the only crossing for Palestinian workers coming from the Gaza Strip. President Zelensky warns Kyiv will put out of talks with Moscow if Ukrainian soldiers hold up at a vast steelworks in Mariupol or killed by Russian troops. Also, France prepares to choose a new president on Sunday in a showdown between incumbent Emmanuel Macron and far-right challenger Marine Le Pen following a bitterly polarizing campaign. Hello and welcome. We are coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. Israel says it's closing the only crossing for Palestinian workers coming from the Gaza Strip. Palestinians denounce the move as collective punishment. The regime says the closure is in response to alleged airstrikes conducted by the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas. Palestinian Workers Union in Gaza criticized the measure, saying it hurts the area's already suffering economy. Hamas officials have also slammed the move as a form of unacceptable aggression aimed at tightening the siege on Palestinians. The resistance's spokesperson told the media that such collective punishments against Palestinians have always proved to fail. Author and Middle East expert Kevin Barrett says Israeli measures against Palestinians fit the very definition of genocide. Let's take a listen.
These 2 million people are packed into 140 square miles. It's the most densely populated zone on Earth. And the Zionists have essentially locked it down and maintained this siege for 15 years now, choking off food and medical supplies and basically, you know, measuring the calories so they can theoretically sort of barely keep everyone alive but without any surplus. So this is an ongoing human rights atrocity. It fits the definition of genocide. Well, the larger war on the Palestinian people fits that definition, according to various scholars of international law. And this crackdown on the current exit of exit of Gaza, preventing people from working, is probably going to just lead to a more tit-for-tat escalation. And it seems that the Zionists are seeking that because they've attacked the Masjid al-Aqsa during the holy month of Ramadan and engaged in other provocations over in the occupied West Bank. So it does seem that for whatever reasons, they're in that part of their cycle where they're trying to ramp up tensions and create problems.
People are taking to the streets across the world in solidarity with Palestinians facing intensifying Israeli crackdown. Rallies were held in European capitals such as Amsterdam, London, and Berlin. The protesters called for international action, including sanctions to end the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories and the regime's growing aggression. More weekend protests have been planned in other countries worldwide, including the U.S., Australia, and Canada. The situation has recently been tense in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, with Israeli forces and settlers storming the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Hundreds of Palestinians have been injured in the ensuing attacks. The violence has drawn international condemnation, with some countries summoning Israeli ambassadors to protest against the regime's violations. The rector of Al-Aqsa Mosque, Sheikh Omar Keswani, has slammed the Israeli regime's violations at the holy site. Keswani held Tel Aviv responsible for the recent escalation of tensions in Al-Aqsa. He said Israel storms the mosque and makes provocations to aggravate the situation. Keswani says the regime backs the settlers who stormed the mosque. The director of the holy site said imposing an age limit on entering Al-Aqsa shows that more escalation would be possible in the coming days. He stressed that not even 1 centimeter of the compound can be divided or shared. Keswani called on Arab leaders to fulfill their duties toward Al-Aqsa. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, who has been following the intensified Israeli crackdown against Palestinian worshippers. Let's see what she had to say.
Well, it's the holy month of Ramadan, and Palestinians here in the occupied territories prefer to go to Al-Quds and to pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. However, Israelis, as usual, continue to put strict measures. Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank are not allowed to enter Al-Quds without Israeli-issued permits, and it's almost impossible for Palestinians to get. The Israelis claim that They gave Palestinians some east, let's say, the measures for the Palestinians in order to enter Al-Quds. However, this was not true. Men over the age of 40 were allowed to enter, women as well on Fridays. However, many Palestinians, hundreds of them, were returned back to their cities and their towns when they arrived at the number of military checkpoints that separate between the West Bank and Al-Quds. This is not only the case, and even the people of Al-Quds, the residents of Al-Quds themselves, they were banned from entering the Al-Aqsa Mosque, especially Palestinian youths and those under the age of 30.
The Ukrainian president warns that talks with Russia might break down depending on Moscow's demands and actions.
If Russia destroys our people and the city of Mariupol, if there are pseudo-referendums in pseudo-republics, Ukraine will quit the process of negotiations.
In a news conference held in the capital Kyiv's metro system, Volodymyr Zelensky said it's now up to his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, to decide if the Turkey peace talks can continue. Zelensky also said it's vital for Ukraine to obtain more weapons. He announced that U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken and Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin will travel to his country on Sunday for talks. Delivery of American-made weapons to Ukraine will be on the agenda. Peace talks between Ukraine and Russia kicked off a few days after the war broke out in late February. They have so far failed to make a breakthrough. Researcher Greg Simmons says Zelensky's suggestion that Russia plans to capture other countries too is just an attempt to provoke them into getting involved in the Russia-Ukraine war.
Ukraine is staring a military defeat in the face. So what this is, it's, as you rightly noted, it's a fear-based appeal, not to Ukrainians, but more widely, Europe and anyone else that would listen. Because obviously, the propaganda and the weapon supplies alone are insufficient to halt the Russian advance. So this is an appeal based on fear that something bad can happen in an invasion, and that something bad can happen to them, an invasion to these countries, whoever they may be, because he doesn't name them. And so people are more likely to react emotionally than logically and dismiss this. This is what the attempt is. So he's trying to get a direct involvement of other countries into the Ukrainian conflict. This is the intention of the appeal.
After a bitter and divisive election campaign, France is preparing to vote for its president for the next 5 years. A runoff ballot pits centrist President Emmanuel Macron against far-right challenger Marine Le Pen. Opinion polls suggest a re-election for pro-European Macron. He won the first round by nearly 28% of the vote, while anti-immigrant Le Pen came in second with just over 23%. The turnout was down 4% from the last election, with voters somewhat disenchanted by choice of candidates. In 2017, Macron beat Le Pen with over 66% of the vote. Macron seeks to become the first French president to win re-election in two decades. A Le Pen victory would make her modern France's first far-right leader and first female president. She seeks to capitalize on public dissatisfaction with the incumbent's economic policy. Purchasing power is voters' top concern, following a huge increase in energy prices and rising inflation. Polls will open at 600 GMT on Sunday. Official results will trickle in through the evening.
France's presidential campaign has concluded, and the nation is set to vote on April 24th. after a debate in which Marine Le Pen didn't attack Emmanuel Macron's controversial record. The final polls have Macron leading by around a 54-46% margin. That's beyond the margin of error, but 30% of voters say they still haven't made up their minds. That means a Le Pen victory appears unlikely, but would not be surprising. Across the country, anti-fascist protests were held against Le Pen, although both candidates employ regular xenophobia and are economic neoliberals. The anti-government yellow vests marched nationwide again, and many had strong words for their biggest nemesis, Macron.
The yellow vests are not likely to vote for Macron, that's for sure. They'll vote for Le Pen or submit a blank ballot. The yellow vests truly represent all levels of France, and what we all want is more participation in our democracy at all levels.
Not only is abstention expected to be the highest since 1969, but over 15% of the country may purposely submit a blank or spoiled ballot. That means almost half the electorate could refuse to submit a valid vote, in an expression of just how many won't be happy no matter which candidate prevails. Exit polls are not allowed to be published in France until the results are unveiled.
The initial results, which have never been wrong in France, are scheduled to be released at 1800 Greenwich Mean Time. A major protest is planned in Paris to begin at 1801 Greenwich Mean Time.
Sri Lankan government loyalists are calling on the Prime Minister to quit as protest pressure keeps mounting over a worsening economic crisis. Media Minister Nalaka Gotahiwa and other senior party members demand the resignation of President Gotabaya Rajapaksa and his brother, Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa. The media minister also called for the resignation of the entire cabinet for an all-inclusive interim government to take over. Gotahiwa says the government lost its credibility after the police killing of a protester on Tuesday. The president has already sacked three cabinet members, but protesters say these cosmetic changes are not enough. The island nation is in the grip of its worst ever economic crisis, with people facing power cuts and shortages of food, fuel, and medicine. The situation has ignited protests, with angry demonstrators camping outside the presidential office for over 3 weeks. Multiple bomb attacks on Hazara community in Afghanistan have left dozens of families in great sorrow. The relatives of the victims call for justice and an end to the violence. Rahmatullah Boghwan reports from Kabul.
Recent deadly attacks in Afghanistan have left Afghan families grieving. Some have lost their parents and some their children. Here we are meeting the family of Shahid Milad, who was killed in Tuesday's school bombing in Kabul. Milad's mother can't speak, as she is in a flood of tears, mourning the loss of her young son. But his disabled father managed to speak with great sorrow.
Milad was a very diligent boy. It was his last year at school. He was preparing himself to enter university. He used to tell me that he was going to become a doctor and make a living so that his father doesn't have to work. He wished to serve his family and society, but unfortunately they took him from us.
In another alley in Hazara neighborhood, another family is mourning the death of a father. After the attack on school students, Mir Hussain went to bring his son home, but he himself fell victim to the second explosion.
My brother was on the roof when he heard a bomb explosion at the school. He quickly went to school to find his son Mahdi. He was searching around when the second explosion occurred. He was injured in the attack, but later at the hospital, we lost him forever.
Mahdi has survived the attack, but he is struggling with the shock of the attack and the pain of losing his father. Likewise, in the west of Kabul, there are many families whose beloved ones are either killed or wounded. They feel despaired and can't hold back their tears. It remains to be seen if the time can heal their wounds. These days, Afghan families want peace and security. People here say they're terrified of repeated blind terror attacks. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Muslims are marking the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Ali, the first Shia Imam. Tens of thousands have descended on the holy shrine of Imam Reza in the northeastern Iranian city of Mashhad to commemorate the occasion. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Ali is one of the most adopted names among Muslims. This is because they have special love for Imam Ali, the first Imam of Shia Muslims. Now to mark his martyrdom anniversary, thousands of Imam Ali's fervent followers have converged on the holy shrine of Imam Reza, who is one of his descendants. Members of this family have traveled all the way from Qatar to take part in the morning ceremonies in Mashhad. Imam Ali was the cousin of Prophet Muhammad and is hailed as the first man to embrace the Prophet's call for Islam. According to Islamic references, Imam Ali rooted out poverty and promoted an unprecedented justice system across the Muslim world during his short rule, based in Iraq city of Kufa. And that's why his character continues to inspire the younger generation, even today. Imam Ali was assassinated on the eve of the 20th day of the Islamic month of Ramadan in 661 AD. He was attacked with a poison-coated sword while he was praying in a mosque in Kufa. 2 days later, he succumbed to his wounds. Muslims erected a magnificent shrine for him in the Iraqi city of Najaf, which still draws pilgrims from across the Muslim world.
Shia Muslims have 12 imams, or religious leaders, with Imam Ali being the first. While all imams are equally revered among Shia Muslims, Imam Ali holds a special position as the father of Shia Islam and the symbol of Islamic justice. Yusuf Jalali from the Holy Shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The toxic output from fires is dangerous, contributing to an estimated loss of more than 15,000 lives in the U.S. each year. Some scientists say that number will double by the end of the century. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Gabriel Cannon under the heading, Study Says Wildfire Smoke in U.S. Pacific Northwest Erasing Reductions in Emissions. Please stay with us to hear more about the details. Scientists at the National Center for Atmospheric Research have found the billowing black smoke that has cloaked the U.S. Pacific Northwest during wildfire disasters in past years has caused atmospheric carbon monoxide levels to spike, with the contaminants offsetting recent reductions in emissions. As the American West faces increasing threats from big blazes that are fueled by a climate that's growing warmer and drier, researchers have documented the impact of smoke on public health. But scientists are increasingly finding that the fires may be part of a feedback loop that could accelerate the change in conditions, and that health impacts officials have long warned would worsen the climate crisis may in fact already be there. Dr. Rebecca Bajholz, a project scientist at National Center for Atmospheric Research, said, our research contributes to the growing body of research that shows that fires, in particular Pacific Northwest region fires, are becoming more important for North American air quality. Bajholz explained, looking at carbon monoxide, a trace gas emitted during fires, researchers analyzed the impact on atmospheric chemistry from 2002 to 2018. Though the scientists relied on carbon monoxide data to guide them, the contaminant also provided a framework to understand how other sources of pollution might be tied to the flames. Her team, which also included scientists from across the country and around the globe, found that the dangerous pollutant peaks in August, when fires are typically raging in the region, but dips during other months. She said the deviation from the annual cycle is telling us that fires are compromising the ability of atmosphere to self-clean. Globally, carbon monoxide concentrations receded by half a percentage point a year over the 16-year study period. But across North America, the scientists found that August was an outlier. Carbon monoxide levels in the atmosphere follow a seasonal flow, driven to ebb and increase through a photochemical process. Prior to 2011, the regions fell in line with this pattern and levels of the pollutants peaked in the spring and waned in late summer. In a more recent period, the researchers analyzed from 2012 to 2018, a new trend began to emerge. In August, when CO was expected to be driven to its lowest points, there were instead spikes. The scientists found that this not only affects atmospheric carbon monoxide, but was found closer to the Earth's surface as well. The deviation from the worldwide trend was the strongest in the Pacific Northwest, where wildfire risks are high during that month. But the effect lingered in data collected in areas across the country and into the northeast of the North American continent. We'll be right back. The study's findings were supported by four different global fire emissions inventories, which consistently showed carbon monoxide fire emissions peaked in the Pacific Northwest in August. Data from two other inventories that catalog emissions from human activity show carbon monoxide was not increasing in the region during the study period, helping the researchers rule out other causes of the August surge and its spread. A growing body of research has shown how wildfires raging across the West can impact the air locally and afar, with the potential to affect millions across the country. Last year, the sun glowed ominously red as far as New York City, shrouded in haze from land burning on the other side of the country. In 2020, which had the worst wildfire season on record, levels of the most dangerous type of air pollution rose by 7% in the U.S., even after the pandemic shutdowns delivered steep reductions in fossil fuel use. The toxic output from fires is dangerous, contributing to an estimated loss of more than 15,000 lives in the U.S. each year. Some scientists say that number will double by the end of the century. According to a separate study published last year, smoke from Western fires has also been attributed to up to 5,900 asthma-related emergency department visits a year. Nearly three-quarters of these visits and hospital admissions tied to smoke inhalation were outside the western U.S.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. You are listening to Viewpoints and analysis on different topics according to the Islamic calendar of the Muslim world. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Brother Sajjad Haider. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
And Brother Sajjad Haider, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for invitation.
So before starting our main discussion, I would like to express my condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Ali alayhi salam in the holy month of Ramadan. That's why we dedicated today's session of the program Viewpoints to the universal character of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And the main question is this: how we can benefit from the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in today's world, in the contemporary world. Sayyid Mohsen, let's start with you. After Prophet Muhammad, the most comprehensive character in the Islam, it is believed by both Sunni and Shia believers, according to different documents, is Ali ibn Abi Talib, Imam Ali alayhi salam. But in today's world, in the 21st century, if we want to learn something from this character, what it would be?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, we can see that even in today's world, there are many writers who are quoting the the sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, and he's been the role model for the mankind since he came to this world. Yes. And even the book Nahjul Balagha, obviously, the peak of eloquence, it's been translated as this. Yes. Name.
Sayyid Razi's book.
Sayyid Razi's collection. Yes. Of the sayings of Imam Ali or the speeches of Imam Ali. This book is a magnificent book, which is being said that it's a treasure, basically. And when we look at this book, even there are many things which can teach us a lot.
Yes.
A Christian writer, George Jardak, who was Lebanese, I think.
Yes, he was Lebanese.
He was a Lebanese writer.
Al-Imam Ali Sautul Adalat al-Insaniya.
Yes. So he talked about the justice of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Yes. And the rights And we know that even in his life, the tenure that he had, the apparent tenure of rulership that he had or governorship, that was for 3.5 years or 4 years. It was basically full of justice.
Yes.
The things that we see, even the wars that he had, he was a role model for everyone, even at the time when he was, because he used to even fight with justice. This is what we lack in today's world. You know, people or the countries who have powers, they invade countries. They do not look at the justice or injustice. We recently have many, you know, wars, the war on Yemen, the war on Afghanistan, on Syria, war between Russia and Ukraine, and other wars as well. We see that generally the governments or the armies, they don't care about the people. There are many things that are mass destruction, like many weapons, and it's against justice. And that's why in the Shia Islam, they have forbidden the manufacturing of atomic bomb.
Yes.
Because it's a mass destruction weapon.
Yes.
Every faqih, all the maraji has given this, this fatwa. So it shows us that in Islam, especially Imam Ali, who is the leader and the successor of the Prophet, according to the Shia Islam, and he's the first Imam, therefore we can see that the justice is the main thing.
Very good.
In this. And then in today's world, we lack justice.
That's all right. That's why it attracted so many people out of the scope of Islam, we can say, and the Shia Islam, to the justice of Imam Ali alayhi salam, not only during his caliphate, and I mean during these 4.5 years, but during all his life, you know, the justice of Amir al-Mu'mineen was really outstanding. Okay, Brother Sajjad Haydar, what about you? How we can benefit from this important character, Imam Ali alayhi salam, in today's lives, in today's world?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, regarding the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam, I think the first step, if you want to benefit from a life and the personality of some person in history, the first step is to know the personality, who the person was. So when we come to Imam Ali alayhi salam, he was one of the great persons of the history. Now, the point here to be noted is this, that we are not talking about a person actually here now. We are talking about actually not only a person, but actually a method, actually a system given by Holy Prophet to the humanity. There are 2 points which I want to manifest, I want to focus here. The first point, that the prophets, there is a very good saying by one of the contemporary scholars. He said, the prophets do not write books. Their books are actually the souls and selves of people. There they mold them in their personalities to the higher merits of ethics and virtues.
That's right.
So that's what their action. So the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam is very much related to the personality of the Holy Prophet. Mm-hmm. So in other words, if you want to know what Islam is capable of, if you want to know what the Prophet has given to the humanity, look at Ali alayhi salam. He manifests the greatest standards of Islam.
Quran and Natiq, they say.
Quran and Natiq.
The practitioner of the Quran.
So even Quran is not a book of Holy Prophet. It's from Allah.
Yes.
So if he, the Holy Prophet brought that hidden, the gift of Quran from the hidden, from Al-Ghaib, Sama Al-Ghaib, but in another aspect, for the people, normal people of today's world, we tell them that in every condition you are living, how much the conditions are hard and difficult, it's possible to bring up and it's possible to nurture people on highest merits of standard. An example is Ali alayhi salam. So this is the one aspect.
Okay.
The other point which I want to talk about, in today's world we see that after the Renaissance and afterward the things in the materialistic system has developed into, that has taken the all order and systems of the world, we see that in ethics, the ethics has been based upon the pleasure.
Yes.
And the economy has been founded upon the capital.
Yes.
And the politics and everything you see is based on materialism. So we very much need in this time to return to a personality like Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Right.
When we are too much indulged, there is too much indulgence to the materialistic life.
Yes.
So we need to return to Ali alayhi salam and his life, and to know the personality. So this emotional attachment even works Okay. And to get out of this miserable, I will call it a miserable state, where the materiality and material aspects are taking over all and overcoming all our human aspects. So it's a good time to return to such a great personality.
Inshallah, mashallah, brother, it was really nice. His teachings, his sentences, his statements, his sermons, letters are really fresh. You know, it is like it was written yesterday. Yeah. When you look at it, just take a look at the letter of Imam Ali alayhi salam to Malik al-Ashtar, you know, when he was sent as a governor to Egypt. You know, nowadays, all the leaders across the world can really benefit from the teachings and the content of that letter. Okay, Sayyid Mohsen, justice and social justice, this type of Hurriya, the freedom that Imam Ali alayhi salam had, you know, in his character, you know, we can say taking care of the orphans, taking care of the destitute. Most of the social movements nowadays, those who are seeking for freedom nowadays in the world, are looking for a paragon, for a role model, for, we can say, a charter of rights. Imam Ali alayhi salam, I think, can be a good example, isn't it?
Yes, definitely Imam Ali is a good example. Why? Because when we look at the history, we see even the sayings of Prophet about Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. The personality that he had, it was, we can say, like, it covered everyone, everything. It was a universal. He was a universal person.
Yes.
The Prophet said about him, like, Al-Aliyu ma'al-haq wal-haqu ma'ali. Ali is with the truth and truth is with Ali. Now, someone can be with the truth, but if the truth is with him, it means he has a high rank. Whatever he does, it's according to the justice and the truth. On the other hand, we can see, like, for example, when Prophet says that I am the city of the knowledge,
yes.
Ali is the door of that knowledge,
the gate of knowledge.
Gate of that city.
Yes. Yes.
And whoever wants to enter the city, he must enter through the gate.
Yes, very good.
So from that aspect, even today, when we want to learn something, when we want to, gain a knowledge, we have to gain some help or take some help from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. On the other hand, in his personal life, as you said, all the movements that we see, it was done by him. For example, you know, today we have people who are living in the streets. Hunger is a lot. There's people who are needy, the poor people, they don't have any food. He used to supply food in the mid of night without everyone knowing about it to those orphans, to those who were needy.
Okay.
And when he passed away, and the day when he passed away and those people couldn't have anything to eat or drink, then
the sustenance was cut.
And they understood that, okay, this was Ali ibn Abi Talib, who was the caliphate of the time. He was the ruler of the time.
Yes.
We don't have any ruler going into the streets and distributing things amongst the people. He was very much careful about the things. For example, you know, today we can see, like, for example, if I have something from my office, I do use it at home as well, for example.
Okay.
But when I'm at my work time, I'm doing my personal things as well. Whereas when Imam Ali alayhi salam, we have this in the history, that he had a candle and he was writing something on the papers of the government. He was basically calculating some of the money that has come to him.
Okay.
And at the same time, he had private guests. So he turned off the candle.
It was Talha al-Zubayr who came to him to visit him. And the candle was
personal,
out.
It was a personal visit.
And the personal candle was on.
So he turned off the government candle, like the candle which was bought from the government's money.
Yes.
And then he turned on the private candle which he bought by his own pocket. So this thing shows us that he was very specific and he was paying attention to many detailed things.
That's right.
Which has effect. Obviously, when we are living in this universe, in this world, we are affecting this world.
Yes.
This world is being affected by us in different means. Those who just believe in the material life, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wasalam was even role model for him.
Mm-hmm.
That if you want to have justice according to this, the way we said, okay, you need to follow the footsteps of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Okay.
If you want justice, if you want to talk about helping people, it is Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. If you talk about the rights of the people, the best judge of the history, we can say, was Ali ibn Abi Talib.
There are so many documents that there has been disagreements between Khulafa al-Rashidin, a specific case when referring to them as a court. They could not answer that, and they referred the case to Ali ibn Abi Talib. You know,
even the right of Imam Ali was being the caliph, the first caliph after the Prophet, apparently.
Okay.
But even we see that when this right was taken from him, he is observed as an opposition. But at the meantime, whenever there was anything which was needed by them, or
yes, any help or any consultation,
yes. He was the first person who used to give his consultation and his advices to the caliph of the time.
Okay.
So it shows us, and the unity that he had. You know, we do not see any dispute at that time of war the way we see in today's war.
No.
At this time that okay. we have between the Sunni, Shia, that's and all right. those. So basically, this all shows us that we need to follow, and even if we want to have any kind of movement, we should follow him, basically.
Okay, that's right. Okay, Brother Sajjad Haider, your final remarks?
Yeah, I'll say that in a time when there, even in the political aspect,
yes.
you see that in the powers in the world today, even starve the nations to death. We see this, they starve the nations to death mm-hmm. just for a political gain. So for nations, it's a time that when they follow a person like Imam Ali alayhi salam, and they return even to their own legacy. Okay, philosophical right. legacy, or if they take lessons from the life of a person like Imam Ali alayhi salam, maybe the things will change in future. And it's I think even in political aspect, it's a good opportunity for humanity to take benefit from the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
That's right. He was a man of action and not only words, you know, because there are so many documents written about the lifestyle of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Taking care of the family, you know, even the family aspect can be also a really good role model. Today in the world, you know, there are so many consultation centers, how to have a family, how to have good relation with your wife, with your children, you know, this and that. Imam Ali alayhi salam, personal life even was a role model and example for so many people. It still can benefit from that.
Yeah, it's the greatest thing. He yes. is a multifaceted person.
Yes,
and right. also being a multifaceted person, he excels in every field. That's
yes.
the point.
Yes, yes.
That's he right. excels in spirituality. So even all the systems which we used to okay. see today in philosophy yes. or either Irfan or other all aspects, we see they look at Imam Ali as the role model, as the leader.
So even physical strengths.
Strength,
you know?
Yeah.
okay. He was, I mean, physically strong too, you know, so many stories about his bravery during the battlefields, you know, defending the religion of Islam. I mean, you cannot find a person who has all these things, all these, you know, great talents in himself, a person who is believed to be the first man among the Muslims, a person who were the first one who believed in Prophet Muhammad's mission, the true successor of Prophet Muhammad, and then the personal life, the social life. His authority over the people in 4.5 years, you know, full of justice, really, really a comprehensive character
yeah.
still can be benefited from.
Okay? But when you come to the core of this all mm-hmm. multifaceted personality, you see him telling that the core issue, mm-hmm. why he is successful in all these fields, he will say his relation with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You
right.
see him worshipping in the nights, and you see him how he used to love Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's
his
right.
affection, his relation with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That was the core issue. That was the core
okay.
Which hold all the characteristics of this great personality.
That's even at his last moment of the life when he was struck by the sword, you know, of Ibn al-Muljam, remembering Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, keeping Allah's names in his tongue, you know, really great, okay?
Yeah, because obviously when we look at narrations by the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the Prophet says that, O Ali, no one knows you except me and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Very good.
So this is the rank that he had. Obviously,
yes.
spiritually, the connection that you have with Allah, the more stronger your connection will be, the more stronger you
that's
will
right.
be. And obviously, he was the perfect, we can say, like man, like
yes.
in Arabic or Persian term, we use insan-e kamil,
yes.
the word.
Yes.
And we know that the insan-e kamil is someone whose whole life is according to the Quran. And that's why these were known as Quran and Natiq.
Yes.
Because they both are the pairs, like
that's right.
we can say. So that's what we can see in the life of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. And there are many things to talk. Obviously.
Many things to talk, yes. Unfortunately, we do not have that much time for today's discussion. But, you know, still, there are so many other talks. We got another program on Arab English Radio, Call of Islam page, called To My Brother. It's about the main teachings of Imam. Ali alayhi salam and his universal character. I invite our dear listeners to refer to that program too. But thank you, Imam Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Brother Sajjad Haider, for your presence in the program. Viewpoints talking about the universal character and the comprehensive personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam. We would like to express our condolences again on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Ali alayhi salam in this holy month of Ramadan. Inshallah, Allah gives us a chance of visiting the tomb of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Najaf al-Ashraf one day, inshallah. Do not forget us in your du'as and supplications during this month of Ramadan. You can visit our website at parstoday.com/Yankal of Islam page 2. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين مرحبا بالتائبين مرحبا بالعابدين في صلاة الخاشعين في رحاب الذاكرين رمضان 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 القانتين.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Pentagon prosecutors have struggled for more than a decade to hold a trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his accused accomplices in the 9/11 attacks. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Carol Rosenberg and Charlie Savage. The piece is titled September 11 Prosecutors Are in Plea Talks That Could Avert a Death Penalty Trial. Stay with us. For more. Prosecutors have opened talks with lawyers for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the accused mastermind of the September 11, 2001 attacks, and his four co-defendants to negotiate a potential plea agreement that would drop the possibility of execution, according to people with knowledge of the discussions. Guilty pleas in exchange for life sentences could bring to an end the long-running case at the War Court, which was set up by the George W. Bush administration and has been mired in pre-trial proceedings focusing on the CIA torture of the defendants. Nearly a decade after the men were arraigned, the military judge has set no trial start date. No deal is expected soon, but guilty pleas resulting in life sentences could force the Biden administration to modify its ambition of ending detention operations at Guantanamo Bay and instead rebrand it as a military prison for a few men. In an earlier failed attempt at such talks during the Trump administration, the accused plotters demanded that they serve their sentences at Guantanamo Bay, where they are able to pray and eat in groups. They specifically did not want to be sent to the Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado, where federal inmates are held in solitary confinement up to 23 hours a day. The five men are accused of directing and training or providing travel arrangements and money to the 19 hijackers who crashed four commercial planes into the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and a field in Pennsylvania, killing nearly 3,000 people. A plea deal would undoubtedly disappoint, if not enrage, death penalty advocates among the victims' family members. But other 9/11 family members, including those troubled by the role of U.S. torture in the case and the delays, might see it as a fitting conclusion. The path to a trial for the accused September 11, 2001 plotters has been impeded by legal and logistic challenges, as well as a nearly two-year closure of the court during the coronavirus pandemic. The discussions began last week amid the latest setback. The judge, defense, and prosecution teams have traveled to Guantanamo Bay for 3 weeks of hearings meant to address disputes over evidence, particularly showing the role of the FBI in the CIA prison network, where Mr. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his co-defendants were tortured after they were captured in Pakistan in 2002 and 2003. But before they could start, Cherub Borman, the lead lawyer for one of the defendants, Waleed bin Attash, asked to step down from the case. She cited an unspecified in-house investigation of her performance and conduct by the Chief Defense Counsel, Brigadier General Jackie L. Thompson Jr. of the U.S. Army. No details were given, but the issue forced a delay in hearings that could stretch for months and provided an opening, according to a participant in the talks, between the prosecution and the defense. A lead case prosecutor, Clayton G. Trivett Jr., wrote on Wednesday to the defense teams proposing that they discuss whether pretrial agreements are possible for all five cases. "While I cannot guarantee that we will come to terms over these next 2 weeks," Mr. Trivett said in an email, "putting a concerted effort focused solely on possible agreements where we are all on board Guantanamo, where your clients and teams are present, may be our best chance of at least determining if deals can be reached." Within days, the five defendants and their lawyers met in the courtroom to compile an initial list of requirements for the guilty plea, starting with removing the death penalty from the case. Lawyers for the five men submitted a joint list on Monday, participants said. Although the prosecutors have begun the negotiations, a senior Pentagon official, known as the convening authority, must approve any deal. The role is currently held by Colonel Jeffrey Wood of the Arkansas National Guard, who is also a lawyer in Little Rock, Arkansas, and was appointed to the civilian job by the Trump administration. Participants said the talks were expected to continue through the month to try to reach some understandings to present to Colonel Wood. The interim chief prosecutor, Colonel George Kraher of the U.S. Army, declined to comment, as did the chief defense counsel, General Thompson. Both men are new to their jobs. Colonel Kraher was mobilized to the job from the Justice Department in October. General Thompson, who runs the defense office but represents no single defendant, took over on 1st of January. A month later, General Thompson wrote to President Biden to introduce himself, according to a person familiar with the matter. The general described the challenges that the military commission system had experienced in getting cases to trial and proposed a new effort to improve relations between prosecutors and the defense, which were strained and not conducive to plea negotiations. In early March, a lawyer at the National Security Council wrote back to General Thompson that the administration would not be taking a position on any of the cases, according to a senior administration official. The letter specifically did not take a position on plea deals, not endorsing the idea, but not discouraging it either. Instead, the official described the letter as saying that President Biden remained dedicated to responsibly reducing the detainee population at Guantanamo, which currently has 38 prisoners from the roughly 780 who were brought there from 2002 to 2008. 10 are charged but have yet to be tried. The White House's letter said that reducing the population could include resolving the pending military commission cases through pretrial agreements, if appropriate, according to the official. But the letter also stressed that the White House would not prescribe what to do with any particular case or otherwise interfere with the process. Caroline Kras, the general counsel of the Defense Department, was copied on the reply. The National Security Council lawyer said, it is not clear what happened next, but on 4th of March, Colonel Kraher met by video conference with the lead lawyers in all current prosecutions and told them his case prosecutors had the authority to begin negotiations. Advocates for closure have suggested that some of the men who face charges could serve their sentences in the custody of another country. Convictions through plea deals might also persuade Congress, which forbids the transfer of detainees to the United States mainland, to lift a restriction for the purpose of incarcerating inmates who have been convicted in secure, more efficient settings. During the Trump administration, the convening authority, Harvey Ryshkov, was exploring the idea of plea agreements. Attorney General at the time, Jeff Sessions, found out about the talks, testimony in court showed, and called Defense Secretary James Mattis, demanding that there be no deals. Defense Secretary James Mattis then fired Mr. Ryshkov, citing unrelated reasons. A core issue is how many of the defendants beside Khaled Sheikh Mohammed would serve life sentences without possibility of parole, and whether some of the accused accomplices with lesser roles in the attacks would serve shorter sentences. Lawyers for two of the defendants, a Saudi prisoner, Mustafa Al-Hosawi, and a Pakistani national, Amar Al-Baluchi, who is Mr. Mohammed's nephew, have described them as ignorant of the 11th of September 2001 plot, when they helped some of the hijackers with money transfers and travel arrangements from the United Arab Emirates. Psychologists conducting interrogations for the CIA waterboarded Khaled Sheikh Mohammed 183 times. Defense lawyers have pursued an overarching theory that because of its actions, the U.S. government lost the moral and legal authority to execute the defendants. Agents also kept the five defendants nude, beat them, strung them up by their arms in chains, and subjected them to steep deprivation during the 3 and 4 years they were held in the so-called CIA black sites before their transfer to Guantanamo Bay in 2006. As part of any plea agreement, the defendants would have to work with prosecutors through their lawyers on individual lengthy narratives known as a stipulation of fact, essentially a prosecution-approved admission of their crimes. Once signed, the men could be brought to court for questioning by the trial judge, Colonel Matthew McCall of the U.S. Air Force, on whether they cooperate willingly with the process. Under war court law, military juries, not judges, sentence defendants who plead guilty generally from a range set in the plea agreement. The Pentagon would need to assemble a jury of U.S. officers to hear the statements and other presentations by both sides, and then issue sentences, even if they're separately capped in secret pretrial agreements. That portion could last many months. People familiar with the talk said a military jury's recent reaction to descriptions of CIA torture of another prisoner in a lesser-known case might have contributed to the willingness of prosecutors to negotiate. In October, the jury condemned as a stain on the moral fiber of America the agency's cruel treatment of Majid Khan, a confessed courier for al-Qaeda, and urged the overseer of military commissions to grant clemency.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.